listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the headline over at Raw Story and in numerous other places, I believe this is a Reuters story coming out of the Tampa Bay Times. A Brooksville, Florida woman who was 5 months pregnant has died after accidentally being shot in the head Saturday while visiting a friend who was showing off his gun collection. Raw Story has been reporting one of these every day for, a year. But the reality is that a child or teen either dies or is injured by a gun, well over 90% of them being in their own home or a friend's home by accident, every 30 minutes in the United States. In 2010, last year for which we have numbers, because Republicans have made it illegal for the federal government to compile numbers, so it's done by private organizations, 18,270 children or teens died or were injured from guns in just that year, that most recent year for which we have numbers. This is startling. Big problem with guns. Another dimension of this is the not just the availability of guns, but the culture of death in the United States. The pro-life, what was called the pro-life movement up until 1975, when the anti-abortion movement renamed themselves and rebranded themselves with some significant donations after the Roe v. Wade decision in 73. The right to life movement in the United States from the early 20th century until 1975 was the anti-death penalty movement. And I find it just remarkable that anybody in America would say, we are here with Saudi Arabia, with Iran, with Yemen, and with communist China as the countries that, and Russia as the countries that are most aggressively using the death penalty, and somehow that's a good thing. But Nandra Enzi is with us. He is a pro-death penalty, anti-crime activist, member of Project 21. If you want to see him over on Facebook, it's at facebook.com/Project21News/info. Nandra, welcome to the program.
Greetings, fellow hostages. Tom, thank you for having me.
Fellow hostages. Who are we hostages of today, Nandra?
You name it.
Yeah, I don't feel like a hostage. I know George Bush tried to sell that to me. That I should be afraid, that I should get duct tape, that I should give him all the money he wanted, whether it was for banksters or for the military industrial complex.
And a patriot act that made us all inmates. You and I agree on that.
Yeah, but I'm I think this is the land of the free and the home of the brave.
I agree.
I'm just not afraid. I'm sorry. They may be there. There's no doubt in my mind, actually, given who I am and what I do for a living, that they're tapping my phone and all that other kind of stuff. And I don't like that, and I'm going to do everything I can to try and stop it. But the reality is I am not afraid, and I think more Americans need to stand up and say that. So how is it that you think that this Saudi system of murder prevention is a good thing for the United States?
Well, it's not a Saudi system, and actually, you already know the facts of how the American—
Well, Saudi Arabia was doing it. Well, actually, Saudi Arabia didn't exist when we became a country, so I can't say they were doing it before we did. But I
understand your concern.
It's biblical.
In a representative republic, in a country that has set standards for humane prosecution of war, which, we can debate, but at least efforts have been made toward that end, how then do we support execution as a means of either punishment or prevention, which is hotly debated, as you well know?
Well, the prevention part's no longer hotly debated. There hasn't been a study published in a peer-reviewed journal in at least two decades suggesting that there's a preventative effect. In fact, the states with the death penalty are also the states that have the highest murder rates.
But all of this goes back, in my reckoning at least, to individual behavior. And just like this gentleman in Arizona who has gotten a lot of press, and I use the phrase loosely, Joseph Rudolph Wood. Now, he was a domestic battler because he chose to be, not because of alien possession or—
You're talking about the guy who was just put to death by the state, and it took 2 hours to kill him.
When he stalked the woman who left him because it was her choice not to be abused by him, When he went to a hardware store where her father was on the phone, he stood and waited for her father to get off the phone, shot and killed the father, shot and killed the woman. Now, this was in 1989. He was executed in 2014. He received far more due process and far more life than the two people he murdered. Now, we can argue about how the execution was administered. We can say whether or not we feel it was humane, and those are all fair assessments. But his end was far more humane than what he imposed on that woman during her career, and of course.
So let me get this straight. You're saying that for some reason, if somebody kills somebody brutally, and let's not go with this guy. Let's go with John Wayne Gacy, somebody who rapes and strangles little boys, beats them to death,
or
eats,
Charles Manson.
Eats parts of them, Jeffrey Dahmer. Should we as a state be eating people? Should we be beating people to, into senselessness? Should we be burying them alive?
No.
Then why are you bringing up this guy's crime?
No, because the facts of the crime are why he was there. I mean, he wasn't just randomly chosen.
No, anybody who kills with premeditation.
Somebody didn't like his mustache.
Anybody who kills with premeditation in a death penalty state may be subject to the death penalty. The question is not, how horrible his crime was. The question is, are we going to be the kind of country that pays somebody to kill people for us?
Well,
now, one of the biggest problems that these states that have the death penalty have right now, Nadra,
some states have chosen not to.
One of the biggest problems that they've got down in Texas, Arizona, and some of these other states is that their executioners are quitting their jobs and are going on disability because they have post-traumatic stress disorder from having killed people. They can't live with themselves. One of the highest suicide rates now is among people who have been involved in executions.
Well, that's a pretty small number of people.
It is a very small number of people, but it's the same thing with soldiers. You tell people, thou shalt not kill, here's a gun, go kill that guy. They can't live with it.
By the same token, do we disarm policemen? Do we disarm soldiers?
That's a complete straw man argument. I'm saying that Mr. Woods, spent the rest of his life in prison, we would have spent several million dollars less, and he would have, if you want punishment and torture, being in prison is no fun at all. He would have had a far longer period of time to experience the pain of imprisonment. It would have saved us money, and we would not be paying people to kill people. I am guessing, Nadra, that you don't trust our government.
Hmm?
I am guessing that you don't trust the IRS, and you think the post office should be privatized and all that kind of thing, right?
No, I'm an individual. So as an individual, do I trust? I don't blindly trust any particular entity or individual. I have to experience, research that individual, research that entity,
right,
and then arrive at a conclusion.
So, in other words, you're not answering the question.
No.
So here's my question, if you're suspicious of government, why would you want the government to have the power to kill you?
The government already has the power to kill me. The government has, as you know, governments say that they have a monopoly on violence, whether we agree with that or not. They have police departments. They have militaries.
But in the context of the death penalty.
And all that predated your my existence.
Now that we're finding that, somewhere between 5 and 15% of people who've been executed were actually innocent.
Mm-hmm.
We're out of time. Nadra, I'll leave you with the last. Thank you much.
Sure.
Thanks much for being with us today. Nadra Enzi, you can see his work over at facebook.com/project21news/info. Thanks, Nadra.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I think it's time for us to join the rest of the developed world and just say, we're really not sounding. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Robert in Cathedral City, California, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Robert, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom.
Hey, what's up?
What I want to...
I'm listening to you.
I can't hear you.
You got to listen to your. You got to talk into your phone and listen to your phone.
I am.
Ignore the TV.
My TV's on mute, and I still can't.
Okay.
Oh, okay. I got it.
Yeah.
What I want to lay out is the what precipitated the subprime mortgage financial collapse. What was going on in the country that precipitated that?
And are you asking or are you asserting?
It's what was actually going on nationwide.
Okay, here's what happened. The banks.
No, I want to tell you. I want to tell you what my.
Okay, all right. So you're asserting. So go ahead and tell me.
What my assertions. Okay, the first thing that was going on is parents were going with children on their job interviews to negotiate wages and benefits. That was the first thing.
As the parent of three adult children, I've never heard of such a thing.
That was all over in the news. Also, the second thing,
Fox found one guy who did it?
What's that?
You mean Fox found one guy who did it?
No, I wasn't watching Fox News. I was watching national news. I was watching local news.
Uh-huh.
Also, what was going on is in the real estate market, people couldn't afford to buy second properties. So what they were doing is they were building their own houses up, their own single family dwellings with 2 and 3 bedrooms. And they were building them up so big that they were called McMansions.
Robert, the theme through all of your stories is that people who got screwed by the banks did it to themselves. And I reject that. The banks were out there aggressively selling these things.
The establishment.
I remember the ads that said, no credit, bad credit history, we will still write a mortgage for you. And it was not because these banks expected these people to pay them back. They didn't care if they got paid back. The reason why was because if they wrote a $100,000 mortgage, that $100,000 mortgage could be tranched into $10 million worth of derivatives that could then be sold to hedge funds and to pension funds.
You're not listening to me.
You're not listening to me, Robert.
These McMansions that were being built, it was flooding the courts. Because there were neighbors that were complaining that their neighbors were building too big a house. The system couldn't afford to have common people going into the court system, flooding it out with these lawsuits.
It's got nothing to do with how the banks brought down the economy.
They had to collapse the economy to keep the people from exercising their rights.
Who's they?
The establishment.
The court system,
the corporations, the banks.
I think they just took everything they could get. They stole as much money as they possibly could. They bought a bunch of politicians and they got the rules changed so that you didn't have to. It used to be that you couldn't, buy a house where your payments represented more than 20% of your income. They did away with that. Used to be you had to prove your income. They did away with that. And you had all these mortgage origination companies that weren't even banks in most cases. They were writing mortgages for the banks, and the banks would hold them literally for 2 or 3 days before they tranched them out and turned them into derivatives. And we ended up with a $700 to $800 trillion derivative market, and it blew up. It's 20 minutes past the hour. It is Anything Goes Summer. And a couple of things that I wanted to share with you. At some point, and as the day goes on, I told you last week about Rex Stout's book, The Illustrious Dunderheads. Actually, let me just read to you. This is Republican Congressman Fish from New York State. The Illustrious Dunderheads is a book that Rex Stout wrote and was published in, let's see here. It's published in 1942 by Alfred A. Knopf. Rex Stout, one of the most famous fiction writers in America. He originated the Nero Wolf series. And these are just floor speeches before World War II. Republican congressman from New York on the floor. See, they were trying to take down Roosevelt. They hated the New Deal, and they didn't want him to get involved in the war because they thought if he was involved in the war, he'd have more power as the executive. You'll remember Colonel Lindbergh was saying, "Yeah, you know, Hitler's not such a bad guy." You know, I mean, he changed his tune toward the end. But anyhow, here's the quote. This is from the Congressional Record, June 22nd, 1940. Now, in 1940, we already had pretty good intelligence that the death camps were happening, that Jews were being murdered. Not to mention that, you know, in 39, Hitler took Poland by 19, and he in 30, what, 6, he took Austria, the Anschluss? I think it was 2 years earlier. I don't remember my World War II history that well. Maybe it was a little later than that. But 39, I do remember he took Poland. And so by 1940, he was well on his way to taking Europe. Here's a Republican Representative Fish. Colonel Lindbergh was right when he said in one of his recent speeches, quote, "Let us stop this hysterical chatter about calamity and invasion that has been running rife these last few days. It is not fit to the people who built this nation. The only reason we are in danger of becoming involved in this war is because there are powerful elements in America who desire to take part in this war." Oh. He continued to say, "Let us have an end to the secret diplomacy and the secret commitments of President Roosevelt that have brought ruin and disaster to France." I guess in June of 1940, France must have fallen to the Nazis. "And from which we have escaped only by a miracle and the will of the American people expressed through Congress to keep America out of war." President Roosevelt alarmed the nation by his inflammatory Italian dagger thrust in the heart speech. Whom do we fear? Do we fear Hitler, who seems afraid to attack England over 20 miles of sea when he would have 3,000 miles to cross over here? This is preposterous. Let's stop this fear hysteria. And then FDR came out and said, "Let's start a draft." And Republican Congressman Fish said, "Peacetime conscription in America is the direct road to Hitlerism, dictatorship, and national socialism. If we adopt peacetime conscription, we are merely copying Nazi methods and ideology." And then he says, speaking of Japan, so this was pretty much the official Republican line in Congress leading up to World War II. It's why it took Pearl Harbor to get us into the war. He said, "Mr. Speaker, the Roosevelt Far Eastern policy of bluff and bluster has driven Japan into the arms of Nazi Germany and fascist Italy. No one in Japan really wants war with the United States. But it is quite evident that this highly proud militaristic nation has gotten tired of being threatened and slapped in the face by us. We must not let our sympathies run away with our judgment and involve us in any Asiatic war 10,000 miles away that has no connection with the defense of the American continent." The last thing Hitler or Mussolini would want to do is declare war upon us. I will say to the gentleman that I feel that the President of the United States has done more than any single man to lead us to the brink of war. This was April 30th, 1941. Then he went on to say, "We don't want any alien philosophies in this country. This is a Christian American nation, and we want to keep it both Christian and American." Whoa. This speech was at the America First meeting in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. It was reported in The Hour, June 14, 1941. And quoting from Breck Stout, when he said this, the audience greeted him with cries of, quote, "The Jews, the Jews." The congressman smiled at this demonstration and continued, "I do not hesitate now to add that as between Hitler and Stalin, I should 100-fold rather be enslaved by Nazi Hitler than by Red Stalin." I think the best thing that could happen on the vast steppes of Russia would be to have the Nazis and the communists continue to fight it out to a finish and destroy each other. If Germany wins, her wage scale and buying power will go up and she will buy more of our products. Yeah, right. "I have no patience with those Americans who tremble every time Hitler sneezes or get jittery every time he opens his mouth." Amazing. If the president should send a declaration of war to Congress, it would be defeated by a 3-1 vote. I repeat, if we enter the war and finally destroy the German army, we can only do one thing, and that is to revive communism and help establish communism in Germany, Italy, Poland, France, all of Europe, with American lives and treasure. It seems obvious to me that if we crush Germany, Germany will go communistic. We in America will be impoverished and bankrupt. We even may lose our form of government and have a dictator such as never been known. Amazing. So, anyhow, our reading for the day from the illustrious Dunderheads. There's a couple of op-eds in the New York Times. The first points out that the typical household in America is now worth one-third less than it was in 2003. 36% decline. Typical household. You know where the money went. It went to the top 1%. America is not richer or poorer. Actually, we're a little richer there. And the other is powerful and cold-hearted by a couple of researchers who found that the more wealth and power people have, the less empathy they have. I think these stories are related, and as we go through the day, I'll tell you why and how.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with your calls and anything goes summer right after this. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in the place where despair is not an option. And speaking of somebody who absolutely lives that, Nancy Skinner running again for Congress, and good on her for doing it. My old friend and colleague, Nancy Skinner, is on the line with us. Hey, Nancy.
Hi, Tom.
So remind me the congressional district in Michigan that you're running in.
It's Michigan's 11th congressional district.
That's right, 11 for 11.
Freaky.
So yeah, tell us how it's going.
11, right? Yesterday, our district got hit by a freak storm, and we had golf ball size hail July 27th.
Whoa.
That caused severe damage. There's photos all over the web. Unbelievable damage. I don't have power.
Right.
I'm at my parents' house. 140,000 people lost power.
Wow.
Trees are down everywhere. And these bizarre ice balls are everywhere, lots of damage to vehicles. And I'm running on climate change. and what people don't understand, right, is
right.
that's the kind of bizarre, odd, it came out, pounded us. And so the whole region, my whole district is kind of out. But as you know, Tom, I'm down to the wire. My primary is Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And I just put on.
As in tomorrow?
Next Tuesday?
A week from tomorrow.
A week from tomorrow,
okay.
I have to mail 33,000 pieces of mail that we just picked up. This is it. This is the win. These are great pieces. I'm talking about renewable energy. The whole, all the climate scientists, as you know, are tweeting about us. Michael Mann and Jason Box and Yale Climate Communication Center are all saying we got to win this race for the climate. I'm up against a pro-fracking, pro-pipeline, two men. And so, you know, in the Democratic primary, who never voted for the president, either of them, and one of them gave thousands to Romney, Snyder, and Mike Rogers. So this is not really a contest about Democrats versus Republicans or progressives or whatever. It's about who's going to, we got to decide who we are and
right.
who's going to win a seat.
So Nancy, if somebody wants to pitch in and help out, where do they go?
I need to raise $8,000 to get this mailing in tomorrow, okay?
Okay?
I've paid for everything else. So they go to Skinner4FORCongress.com. Tom, they can watch that video I put together about
mm-hmm.
how urgent climate change is. It's called 11-11-11, $11 for the 11th district for one candidate who will lead on climate change. And I'm working with a lot of the internet, all the Mariblog, and all these other folks to create an Emily's List for climate change candidates. So once I'm elected, then we're going to set up a whole infrastructure so that we can find the path to elect more. Because, even in the Democratic Party, you have those that are fearing change. They fear change.
And in some cases, the Joe Manchins of the world, they just come from districts that are so completely captured by the fossil fuel industry that regardless of what they believed, if they said it out loud, they'd never have a political future. But I think in Michigan's 11th district, people get it.
Seat of the the auto industry, and you know where I am, a lot of them live here. But you know, I almost won in 8 years ago. I lost by just a few points. So it's really not that we're dependent on coal. And actually, Michigan, it's so, you're from Michigan, you understand, we have the manufacturing and engineering infrastructure to be creating all those wind turbine engines and solar arrays and advanced batteries. We have all this idle capacity from the auto and the industry. So it's the best thing that can happen to Michigan. We have 21% of the fresh water supply on the planet. I've already gotten some action. This is funny, Tom, because there's two oil pipelines underneath the Straits of Mackinac that carry 2.1 million gallons of tar sand oil through them a day.
Whoa.
And some divers went underneath there from the National Wildlife Foundation, got video. I posted it on my website. It's to scare the heck out of you. SkinnerForCongress.com, because they were laid in 1958, and they're in total disrepair. And so I have been talking about this since day one and had the video out there, and I went on a local TV, the ABC TV show, and said, when I was asked what my first action would be as a congressperson, I said, I would have hearings to hold this company, Enbridge, who also did all the Kalamazoo spills. I would have bring them in to say, what are you going to do about this? This is a big problem. Bill McKibben came to Mackinac last summer to say, we've got to do something about
that,
this.
That is great.
And guess what?
Nancy,
after that show, they got a letter from the AG.
Nancy, you know this business. I've got to move along, but let me just say it again. Skinner, S-K-I-N-N-E-R, 4-F-O-R, congress.com is Nancy's website. And she's running on the economy and is trying to get this mailer out here tomorrow. So get the on over there. Nancy, good luck. Thanks for dropping by.
Thanks, Tom. Okay.
Good talking with you. Jesse in Miami, Florida. Hey, Jesse, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, I tried to get in with Bernie last week, but I couldn't. But what I'd like to say is the investigative reporters are reporting about the problems that could end the It was a story in the Miami Herald last week talking about the post office. Bernie was talking about that.
Uh-huh.
And the story was about the post office becoming a bank to supplement its funding because it's so short because of what the GOP did.
Right.
So the idea would be, at the end of the story, the lady was asking, would postal bank be better than a pay loan by the week thing? And the activist investigative reporter could answer that question and solve the problems of the world by reporting about, would a postal bank be better than a payday loan thing?
Oh, it would be infinitely better because
the stuff we got to go through for loan and lending and all of that.
No, it would be infinitely better. It's just Congress has to authorize it, because right now Congress has prevented that. But and you've got a whole payday loan industry that's basically a little mini mafia that's opposed to it. But you know, I'm with you, Jesse, and everybody should be contacting their member of the House of Representatives and their two senators and saying, hey, wake up. We want the post office to be able to do more than it's doing, more than just sell stamps. We'd like them to be able to wrap packages. We'd like them to be able to operate as a small bank, you know, for people who can't otherwise bank. We would like them to we'd like to be able to get and send an email from the post office. I mean, there's so many things that the post office could be doing, but, you know, right now the law prohibits it. And if they did,
if the reporters could let the people know something to compare to instead of the politicians trying to preach to them, because
the post offices in most countries do all these things.
You control the message, you control the people.
Yeah, the post offices in most countries do all these things, and ours should too. Jesse, thanks for the call. Dr. Robert Lesney in Orlando, Florida. What's up?
Yeah, hey Tom. I just wanted to comment. I just wrote a book on perceptions, echoing what you talked about, the visual, auditory, tactual, kinesthetic, gustatory, olfactory concept.
Oh, what we were talking about last week. Primary perceptions.
So it's kind of schizophrenic day. Well, the purpose of my book is to show that the DNA dictates that you pick an opposite. That's why people are unhappy in the marriage. So there's no redundancy, no inbreeding, different immune system. So in my book, I talk about right brain people marrying left brain people, nearsighted people marrying farsighted people, you know, all this stuff. You also somaticize your perceptions, because if you're kinesthetic, you say, oh, my aching back, and And everything is really tied up to how you process information and form meaningful relationships on a perceptual basis.
Yeah.
So this is so important that if people knew, for instance, you go to a store, you pick up something, you walk around, you put it back. It's your reptilian brain, your limbic system, that dictates that you should pick it up. And then after you go to the intellectual brain, then you say, I don't really need it. I'll put it back. The same thing with people, the same thing with political things. It's all based on the perceptual, you know, valiance.
Yeah, what's the title of your book?
Opposites. I'm editing now, okay. Looking for a publisher.
Here's let me throw a possible, I mean, I don't know if this absolutely confirms what you're saying or if this challenges it or if it's just a tangent that's worth exploring. But, you know, I used to talk about this a lot. I've done a lot of speaking on this topic, and much of it in indigenous communities in North America, on Indian reservations in the United States, up in Canada. Don Morin, who was then the premier of the Northwest Territories, invited me up there, and he brought in indigenous leaders from more than 200 tribes all around, and we did this weekend thing at Yellowknife, and I've done this as well with Aboriginal Australians and Aboriginal Africans in Africa. And what you find is that people who live indigenous lifestyles tend to be, about 70% of the society tends to be kinesthetic. Their primary modality is kinesthetic. They're only secondarily auditory, typically, and tertiarily visual. Whereas people who live in Western society are principally visual, secondarily auditory, tertiarily kinesthetic. And the assumption for a long time was that this was Native people versus white people. But it turns out that Native people, for example, you know, Native Americans around Phoenix who a generation ago moved into Phoenix, when you test them and their kids who grew up in quote, modern society rather than on the res, a very small percentage of them are kinesthetic, whereas their blood relatives on the reservation, very high percentage of them are kinesthetic. So it appears that there's a huge cultural element here.
Well, this is the stresses is positive, negative, neutral stresses. But one of the most important things that you would be interested in is I have a whole chapter of myopes.
Yeah.
And myopic people, that psychological myopic people, they process information on the near point plane. They're rigid, recalcitrant. They don't color outside the lines.
Huh.
Interesting. They like.
I wonder if
they're mostly engineers.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a piece of epigenetics in here too. You know, epigenetics is where your DNA gets turned on or off by external influences, and I wonder if culture could be flipping certain genes on and off. Anyhow, interesting. Dr. Robert Lesney, thanks. Opposites. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's fascinating stuff. You know, visual people say, I see what you're talking about. Auditory people say, I hear what you're saying. Kinesthetic people say, yeah, I got a good feeling for that. That's what we were talking about. Welcome back. David in Benton Harbor, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, David, you wanted to talk about the Michigan election coming up a week from Tuesday?
Yes, I did. And maybe you can call back your friend Nancy Skinner and find out some more information about a proposed amendment to eliminate the personal property tax.
This is an amendment to the Michigan Constitution or a ballot initiative?
Yeah,
or?
It's supposed to be an amendment to the Constitution to eliminate the personal property tax, which would cause a tax shortfall for all the local governments and school districts.
Wow. So this is let's do to Michigan what Sam Brownback did to Kansas.
It looks like it might do that. However, my local representative at the state legislature, Al Pasolik, did have a telephone town hall meeting where he talked about starting a commission to cut tax loopholes to repave the lost revenue that elimination of the personal property tax would create.
Hmm.
However, they never mentioned what the tax loopholes were. And right away, we know there can't be the federal tax loopholes,
right.
So they have to deal with the state. And the only one that I can really think of would affect senior citizens and lower-income property owners,
right.
Which would Right now, we can get back a certain amount of our property tax through a rebate from the state. And I'm afraid that's the tax loophole that they're going to start talking about.
Well, if it's Republicans, you can bet on it. I mean, it's like that's how they roll. You know, it's like it helps working people. It helps poor people. It helps the middle class. Screw them. You know, we were put into power by the fat cats. And yeah, amazing. David, I'll look into it. Thank you for the heads up on that. It makes perfect sense. It makes absolutely perfect sense. Michael watching Free Speech TV in Imperial Beach, California. What's up, Michael?
Hey, Mr. Hartman, on the road, so this is not a written question, so this is off the cuff. You were saying once that the Iroquois Nation decided at one point in time, the question I want is now how many thousands of years ago, is that men were not working, and that in four out of the five Iroquois nations, women were the only ones who could vote.
Right.
Do you think that all this stuff that's going on in the world, you know, Iraq, ISIS, Israel, Boko Haram, you know, these are all male-orientated things. Do you think it's because men are in the final throes of understanding that we have to turn over control of our world to women?
Or at least share it equally with them. Yeah, I think so. And you look at the countries like in Norway, it's mandated by law that 40% of the legislature be female. In Iceland, I don't know if it's mandated, but it's custom that it be half. Iceland, of course, is a matrilineal matriarchal society, so everybody has daughter at the end of their name. You're named after your mother, not after your father. So instead of being Soren's son, it would be Soren daughter, or it would be Susan daughter. And but yeah, I think that, you know, let's not leap from patriarchy to matriarchy in one giant swoop. First of all, it's not going to happen. But let's take patriarchy down a step or two. Let's we're up to 16% female representation in the U.S. Congress, at least in the House of Representatives. Let's and it's almost all Democrats. And you know, let's try to get that to 50% in the House and Senate. Step one, Michael. Thank you. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Travis in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Travis. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hey. Well, I wanted to call in. Last time I called in, I wanted to talk about Mincom, but I wound up going on a tangent about something else. So today, I wanted to say, you know, we've been talking about income inequality, and I think a way to get conservatives and progressives on board is to go with a system that I call Mincom, which is basically a negative income tax that's given to everybody every month, which is on your livable wage. So
in other words, a guaranteed minimum income.
Yes. And let's say everybody makes like $25,000 a year, because that's how much it would cost to live in this community. Those who can afford to pay it back in taxes. Those who don't pay. Those who need it, don't pay it back. We eliminate all the overhead. We don't have welfare programs. We don't have unemployment insurance, all these other things that we have. And you don't have to qualify into it. You just get it.
Right.
We ran this program in Canada, and it was called Mincom, and it only got canceled because of a changing government, which is one of the negatives I find in Canada. So, you know, one government comes in, and then everything changes.
Yeah.
But
was it Harper killed it off?
It was. I mean, this was back in the 70s, so
oh, okay.
Before that.
Yeah,
but
okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great, and actually now that they're looking more into it, they sealed off all the documents, but now the University of Manitoba has been unsealing these documents, and it turns out GDP increased. People aren't going to the healthcare. Billions of dollars would be saved in healthcare costs because people are taking care of themselves. They're eating right. They're quitting jobs that are putting them into abusive situations. I mean, in general, it's a great thing, and I think that that's, I think people are afraid of it, though.
Well, they have this in Alaska, you know, and
right,
Alaska has some of the lowest income disparity in the United States. And in fact, Sarah Palin so hyped this thing, so amped it up. Typically, you know, you get between $800 and $1,000, maybe $1,200 per year per person in your household. And she's got five kids, so she's got seven people in her household. So she'd get $7,000 a year. In 2007, it was a little over 2,000, so she got $14,000 that year. But in 2008, when she was running for vice president, she had sued the oil companies. They got a settlement from the oil companies. There was an extra tax on oil that they got, and she tossed all of that into the pot. And her family alone made over $40,000. In fact, I've read as high as $48,000 that year. And that's a family of seven. But, you know, family of four would have made $20,000, roughly. And it was a pretty good year for Alaskans. And, you know, obviously she was doing it because she wanted people to vote for her and John McCain for president. But, you know, now it's back down to in the neighborhood of $1,000 a month. But still, Alaska's been doing this for since the mid-70s, and it works quite well.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that that's what I'm curious, though, is like, why is something like this? And again, I still think that Alaska doesn't go as far enough. It's because they rape the land, and then they get right. subsidies for that advantage. But I mean, is it because it sounds too much like socialism? Like,
sure.
What? Because I mean, we even have people again in Canada. Even one of our conservative senators have looked at this and said, yeah, we're saving so much money through this. It's not socialism. It's us saving money. But
you'll recall. Let me give you an answer, Travis. You'll recall last week when I was going through. I think it was Thursday. We were going through my book, Cracking the Code, and the first chapter is about the conservative liberal code. You know, how do conservatives think? What is their worldview? How do liberals think? What is their worldview? And if you read, for example, Paul Ryan's new program to, quote, solve poverty. Basically, what he's going to do is have every poor person in America sign a contract committing to get themselves out of poverty within a certain period of time. And then they'll be measured about whether, you know, with milestones, and they will be measured on whether or not they fulfill that contract. And if they don't, they get punished. And if they do, they get rewarded. Now, all of this is based on the assumption that poor people have chosen to be poor. And therefore, you have to provide them with either incentives or punishments to get them out of being poor. And it doesn't acknowledge the structural poverty that is built into our society, whether it's the racial dimension of structural poverty, racism, whether it's the gender dimension of structural poverty. Women make 70 cents on the dollar and black women make 50 cents on the dollar. And single women are less likely to be able to be employed than married women, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Or whether it's the where you were born or how you grew up. You know, if you grow up in poverty, if you speak something other than, quote, you know, contemporary English, and you don't even have the ability to speak, you know, whatever you want to call it, white English. If you some people can do that and they can speak other variations of English, others can't. All of these things help determine whether or not a person is going to be in poverty, not choices that they're making. There's maybe a very, very small percentage of people who are choosing to live in poverty. And by and large, those are people who are mentally ill and end up homeless. And so the reason why this topic that you're talking about doesn't get brought up, and the reason why when it does, it gets opposed by people like Paul Ryan in the United States, Stephen Harper in Canada, is because it does not assume that people want to live in poverty. It assumes that if somebody wants to work, they want to work because there's an intrinsic joy or dignity in work. And see, even that, I mean, before the Reagan Revolution, we had this predicating assumption in America, which came along with the middle class in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, that any kind of work, whether it was, you know, no matter what it was, any kind of work had dignity associated with it and therefore should provide a certain minimum standard of living. I remember watching as a kid the old Jackie Gleason show, The Honeymooners. He drove a bus. His best friend, Ralph Cramden, worked in the sewers in New York City. Both of them were in the, quote, middle class, right? So you didn't need to have a college degree. That whole idea that people who work that should have a decent life and that there's dignity associated with it, even if they don't have the highest IQ, Jackie Gleason played a buffoon, you know, even if they're not a rocket scientist, that's actively being knocked down. I mean, you know, just on Fox a couple of days ago, they had, you know, maybe it was yesterday, one of their commentators said, you know, some people aren't smart enough to be able to qualify for a good job and therefore don't deserve to be in the American middle class. And that's why I think, you know, that's that conservative worldview that people are choosing. People are inherently evil and they will choose poverty. They'll choose a handout if they can. And history doesn't demonstrate that. Travis, thanks for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and very pleased to have with me in the studio Mayor Adam O'Neill, the Republican mayor of Belhaven, North Carolina. The website's saveourhospital.org, and you can tweet him at Mayor O'Neill. It's just as it sounds, M-A-Y-O-R-O-N-E-A-L. And Mayor O'Neill, it's great to have you live in the studio.
Thank you for your support. I really appreciate you taking an interest in our story and sticking with us the whole route.
I think it's an amazing story, what you have, what your town has gone through, what you're doing. You even had a woman die recently as a consequence of there's her picture. What's her name?
Portia Gibbs, 48 years old, three kids, got a husband, and passed away from chest pains and then having a heart attack without getting treatment promptly.
Because the hospital had been closed in your town because...
Instead of getting emergency treatment in 25 minutes, they waited for a helicopter for an hour, and she expired just as a helicopter landed.
Amazing. Amazing. Beautiful woman.
Yeah.
I mean, whether she was pretty or not, it doesn't matter. That's a terrible thing. So what, you just marched from Belhaven, North Carolina. You just walked from Belhaven, North Carolina to here in Washington, D.C. Why?
Well, it's 273 miles. And I remember when I first got the idea to do the walk, it didn't seem like walking was going to be that big a deal, that I could do it. Just needed to take the time. But it was a very difficult thing to take on physically. But the reason we did it was because people are dying. People like this are dying in my community now due to no emergency room. We had a critical access hospital in my community that was put there by the Hill-Burton Act back in the late 1940s. Because you have these rural areas that are so geographically challenged for health care that the government got involved in setting up some hospitals to take care of folks, making sure they had adequate emergency care. Well, what happened with us was a few years ago, this big healthcare conglomerate came to us and took over our hospital. We actually gave them $1 million more in assets than they took in liabilities. They took over our hospital and promised to maintain and strengthen it. Mm-hmm. And then within 2 years, they announced they're going to close our hospital. Well, our hospital is essential to our healthcare, but it's also the economic engine for us.
Right.
These small communities around the country, rural hospitals are the economic, a lot of times the biggest employer. They draw people to town. It's a big deal. Plus, our biggest industry in Belhaven, North Carolina, is the water and is retirees coming down to retire.
Right.
Well, without a hospital, that's over. That's dead, too.
Right.
So this big conglomerate came in, acted as though they were going to help us, and then ended up telling us they were going to close our hospital.
Now, if I understand the mechanics of the background of all this, it's that the act in the 1940s, it was sort of like the Rural Electrification Administration, the Rural Telephony.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was basically the, Roosevelt or Truman or Eisenhower did a lot of this, too. Let's bring rural America up to the standards of urban America.
It was Republicans and Democrats working together.
Working together, exactly. And that's why I say, Eisenhower did it, too. And for that matter, Richard Nixon would have done it. I mean, this was back in the days when Republicans and Democrats worked together. When Obamacare was passed, the assumption was that every state was going to take a Medicaid expansion and that would cover working people, people who were making too much to qualify for the dirt poor, unemployed, disabled Medicaid that states provide.
Right.
But were not making enough to be able to buy insurance, so or to qualify for the Obamacare exchanges.
Right.
And so when the Obamacare law was written, it basically undid that 1940s law. It cut back on the subsidies to these rural hospitals because, hey, you don't need to subsidize the hospital anymore if everybody showing up has got insurance.
Exactly. And what happened was the Affordable Care Act starts reducing reimbursements for indigent care, people who can't pay,
right?
Because Medicaid expansion fills that void.
That's right.
And when these states don't take Medicaid expansion, you've got a recipe for disaster. And when you have rural hospitals that fight every year to break even, and due to foundations and givens and all, that's how they make it, you've got a disaster.
Right. So your state has officially not taken the Medicaid expansion. And so between the perfidy of the state legislature and the perfidy of this corporation that's looking to make more money by consolidating their hospital 60 miles away from you or something like that,
right?
The good citizens of Belhaven are screwed.
Well, the other part of this story, other than Medicaid expansion, is this big conglomerate that came to town that owned like nine hospitals. They made $127 million in 2012. They made $109 million in 2013. They've got $550 million of reserves.
Whoa.
And they closed a critical access hospital that lost $1.2 million in 2013.
That's nice.
That $1.2 million was less than half of what their CEO makes, one man at a nonprofit. Wow. And it's a nonprofit making over $100 million a year off the people of Northeast North Carolina, and they closed a critical access hospital. That's why we walked to Washington, D.C.
They're making $1 million in profit every 3 days.
And here's the other thing. Our hospital served about 20,000 people. Well, our hospital doesn't do heart surgeries and cancer treatments. So those 20,000 people were actually going to Vidant Health to their other facilities.
Right.
So Vidant actually was making money off of 20,000 people.
So your hospital became a feeder into
small hospitals are.
Right.
And then to go close one, especially a critical access, that's a special designation,
right?
Because this hospital needs to survive for these people.
It's basically an ER.
Exactly. It's an ER with some beds. Of course, it was more beds back in the day. But you have this greed and immorality that is going on in healthcare that's got to be stopped.
Right.
So we walked to Washington, D.C., spoke today with the Capitol in the background, hoping that some representatives will say, hey, look, it's not okay for a nonprofit to make $100 million a year, have $500 million in reserves, and start closing critical access hospitals to try and pad their bottom line. This is wrong.
Well, I absolutely agree with you, and I can see where that message might resonate with people regardless of politics.
It's happening all over the country.
On the other hand, the message that we need to take the Medicaid expansion in North Carolina so that that hospital and other small critical care hospitals will actually be funded,
right?
That message has been turned into something that's highly partisan. How are you dealing, you're a Republican, how are you dealing with your own party in North Carolina on that?
I'm not a genius, but it looks like to me that Medicaid expansion is going to happen sooner or later.
Right.
The people are going to put it on us one way or the other. If you can deny it all you want to. I'm concerned for my party that in November they're going to have a tough time in the elections with people knowing that they've rejected Medicaid expansion. You know, people don't hear you until they know you care.
Right.
And the Republicans in North Carolina have done some amazing things, some great things. Well, all they need to secure a majority in the future is to jump on board with this and show that they care for people.
Yeah.
It would be the grand slam. It's politically exactly what they need to do. The governor would never have to worry about reelection again. Everything, they would be in such a great position, and they are completely missing this.
Yeah, I think you're right, and it's this ideology that somehow if we are helping each other out, that's communism or something. Yeah.
Well, it's like I walked 273 miles with the civil rights legend Bob Zellner, who has certifiably been charged with anarchy before. And I was like, wow. I said, you're a flaming liberal, Bob. He said, no, I'm a radical.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm reaching across the aisle to folks of all different ideologies because it's something all of us agree we all need to live. We all agree that Portia doesn't need to die. So I think it's something that Democrats and Republicans can all work together to make this happen. And I told the governor in the speeches in North Carolina, if you don't want to accept Medicaid expansion, okay, well, what's your plan for saving these rural hospitals? Because they have to be saved.
Right.
And if they're closing, people are dying, and that's not okay.
Yeah, and in fact, people have died in your very community. We're talking with Mayor Adam O'Neill. He is the Republican mayor of Belhaven, North Carolina. The website is saveourhospital.org. You can tweet him at Mayor O'Neill. And how long are you going to be in D.C.? What are you doing here?
A couple of days. I've got four children, and I got to see them first time last night, and we're going to hit the zoo.
Oh, that's great. Play tourist. This is a beautiful city. It's an absolutely beautiful city. Mayor Adam O'Neill, Republican Mayor of Belhaven, North Carolina, saveourhospital.org. Get over there and check it out right now. Help them out. Let them know that you're paying attention.
Donations.
Yeah.
We need some donations.
Donations. Okay.
If anybody's got a little bit extra money,
you,
please
send you can help out. Please do it. Saveourhospital.org. Twitter at Mayor O'Neill. Mayor, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank.
Great to have you with us.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Once again, that is at Mayor O'Neill and saveourhospital.org. We'll be back with Anything Goes Summer. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bill in Anza, California, watching us on Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, Tom. How are you doing today?
Good. What's up?
Okay. I just wanted to say we took a trip up to the Garlic Festival this weekend up to the Central Valley, and we noticed something very odd, and it didn't click into my mind until this morning. No bugs on the windshields, and that is very odd for driving through there. Thank you, Monsanto.
Do you think it's Monsanto, or do you think it might be climate change, that it's so dry that the bugs can't come out?
It's something, and I think people need to take notice to this, because that's pretty bad. You know, we have a small little farm out here in Anza, and, you know, it's organic, and we worry about the bugs. And if there's no bugs, there's no pollination, and you got a serious problem in this state. So I don't know what's going on,
right?
You know? And I was just hoping that if there are any other biologists out there, you know, take a notice of this, because no insects are bad for this country.
Yeah.
The world.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Bill, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for raising the red flag. Maybe we'll have some other people who are saying the same thing. John, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network in Cayucos, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I've been meaning to ask you this question. You got that one strange phone call earlier in the last hour from the guy that was talking about why the housing collapse.
He had reason after reason after reason about why the Bush crash of 2008 was caused by basically poor and middle class people. And that's the main meme of the bankers. That's what the bankers are pushing this stuff.
Yeah, that was just strange. I don't know. But anyway, it reminded me of the question I wanted to ask you. And I was going to, I just wondered if any of the people who got screwed by the banks and the insurance companies and all the people involved in the derivative markets on Wall Street that were betting on bets on top of bet, and then AIG insuring these bets and blah, 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 blah. They all, it seems to me, knew what they were doing, which would require conspiracy between them, or collusion anyway. And if you can prove that they actually stole your wealth, your money, aren't they guilty of violating your civil rights, since now money is speech? They've basically taken away your...
Well, that's, you know, I was about to say no until you said that. I mean, you know, yeah, if money is speech, and if speech is a right guaranteed by the First Amendment and thus a civil right, and if a corporation is stealing your money, they are stealing your speech, they are taking away your right to buy a politician.
Yes.
Very, very interesting basis for
that. I had that $500,000 I was going to give to candidate so-and-so.
Yeah.
And you foreclosed on my house, took it away. I don't get my money. I don't get to sell my house. I lost all my $500,000 and all the money that I had in equity.
Right, and I can't buy a politician now, so my rights have been violated. Amazing.
Yes.
This is something we got to run by Mike Papantonio. Maybe.
Yep, that's who came to mind, too.
In fact, you know, he's going to be on the show on Thursday when he comes on. Call us back and remind us, would you, John?
I will.
I think it's a great one. I think it's an absolutely great one. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. the Tom Hartman Program, talk media for the sane among us, and Richard in Victoryville, California. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, the mayor that you were talking to a little while ago from back east, the Republican mayor who's fighting to keep that hospital,
mm-hmm.
the battle he's fighting in a nutshell is the essence of the point that I was getting ready to make, and that we have been conditioned in this country over the last 35 or 40 years that everything in a capitalistic society is supposed to be for sale, and it's always to the highest bidder.
Right.
And unfortunately, you know, that might work in a corporate structure, but our government is not a corporation. It is not supposed to run as a corporation. Our government is to provide services for the people. And there is no profit to be made there. And unfortunately, the Republicans, they want to run everything like if it's not turning a profit, then it needs to disappear.
Right.
That's they don't understand what the whole purpose of a government is supposed to be.
Yeah. Hang on just a second. Hey, Shane. The mayor left here this photograph. I'll set it over here. You can grab it. Maybe you can track him down. Give him a call, whatever. I am totally with you, Richard. This is the death of civics in America, is that we don't understand anymore the difference between public and private. We don't understand that government was created. Well, actually, you know, it's like, The second half of the sentence in the Declaration of Independence that never gets quoted, it's literally the second half of the sentence, and for some reason they completely, it's a run-on sentence, but it's a fairly long one. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Dash. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its power in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and their happiness. So,
if you notice with our politicians, every time the people come up and there's a poll that says 80% of Americans want this, that, or the other, the politicians sit here and tell us, well, we don't really know what it is we want. They know better than we do.
Right.
And this is all in an end for them to keep their political power. It has nothing to do with actually serving the purpose that they were elected for.
Yeah. I'm completely with you, Richard. And this, as I said, I think this goes back to just a basic ignorance of civics in the United States, which goes back to Ronald Reagan making Bill Bennett the Secretary of Education, the guy who thought the Department of Education should be abolished, and pretty much the end of teaching civics in the United States, which is a real tragedy. If we're going to have Common Core, I understand, arithmetic. I think, frankly, civics is more important. Arithmetic is really important stuff, and people who want to be engineers will figure it out. They'll learn it. But civics, we need to be teaching in our classrooms. Richard, thank you for the call. Joe, in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, you are a physician, and you wanted to comment on Mayor Adam O'Neill's presence on the show?
I did. And, you know, my comment, you were very gracious to him, and that's because you're a gracious host, Tom. But, man, I had some questions. I'm glad you asked him about Medicaid expansion, because I would bet a lot of money that this guy has supported most Republican policies, up to and including opposing the Affordable Care Act when he campaigned in the past. Now he's lost his hospital, and it's coming back to bite him in the butt.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's all true. That doesn't make him an evil person. It makes him somebody who's capable of learning.
Well, wait a minute. It doesn't make him an evil person, but he came back and said he's still a Republican because Republicans have done a lot of good in the state of North Carolina. I'd like to know what good they've done. I heard they're trying to restrict the ability of people to vote in the state of North Carolina,
yeah,
the Republicans. So I don't know what good exactly they're doing.
Joe, here's the simple political calculus. If this guy, and this is the reason why I didn't take him apart in the way that you're describing. If Mayor O'Neill genuinely You know, I think he's a genuinely good guy. We've talked to him a couple times. I met him. I spent some time with him before we went on the air. I think he believes that he's doing the best thing. I think a lot of Republicans do. I know my father did. He went to his grave thinking that the Republican Party was the best for America. I disagree with him, but I think that there's a lot of people who genuinely think that Republicans are decent, and I think this guy was one of them. And if he is going to continue to be successful as an elected Republican mayor of a small town in South Carolina pushing for an expansion of Medicaid in that state, if he's going to be successful at turning around the party that he's part of, that you and I agree is almost a criminal enterprise, the Republican Party, it's at least corrupt, totally in the bag with the billionaires and the politicians, using all kinds of race-baiting stuff, you know, that deals with immigration or voting or welfare or any of that. Anyhow, if he's going to be effective in changing that party from within, he's got to say things like, I'm a Republican and there's some good people here. Because otherwise, he doesn't get reelected. And I'd like to see this guy get reelected because he's, you know, one of the rare, decent Republicans I've ever met.
Well, I tend to agree with that. I suspect I would rather see his Democratic opponent.
But that's not going to happen. He lives in a town where everybody watches Fox News and they all vote for Republicans.
Right, right. Well, and they're all in the same situation. I would guarantee you that most of them supported giving this private nonprofit corporation control that hospital because they probably got a few bucks.
Sure. Yeah. Hey, it's privatization. That's got to be good, right? Yeah. Privatization's always good. Right. That's the Republican mantra. No, I get that, and he gets that. And those decisions, although he didn't make that decision, that was a decision that was probably made at the level of the county or the state legislature. But that decision has come back to bite him and his community in the butt, and has killed this young woman whose picture he was carrying with him. And so, Joe, I think that what we need to do is get behind this decent man. Get over to Save Our Hospital, ourhospital.org, saveourhospital.org, and help him out. We'll be back. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. I am totally with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And it's Anything Goes Summer. Not yet August, but it's sure hot out. We'll be back with your calls right after this. Exposing the con and conservative, it's the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person, or for that matter, Hobby Lobby? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. It's a corporation. Come on, get real. Scalia, Thomas, Lloyd in Framingham, Mass. Hey, Lloyd, what's up?
How you doing?
Great. I've been in your town. It's a nice town.
Actually, this is the first time I've ever called you. I've been listening to you for many years.
Well, thank you.
And love your show and love what you do.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I'm a town meeting member here. And I think you're from Vermont or live there, so I think you know what a town meeting member is.
Yeah, I lived there for a decade.
Okay.
So, for people who are listening who don't know what we're talking about, why don't you explain it very briefly?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, originally I'm from Jersey, so, you know, I grew up in a mayor and a town council type of government. Here, there are some vestiges left over from colonial times where town meeting simply means actually, the entire community could show up. Usually, you know, landed men, you know, people who own property could show up, be a part of their government when government is in session. And it's lasted here for 300 years.
Right.
There's only about 30 towns and cities that really have that still. And so I am one of those people that's a town meeting member.
That's great, at least in Massachusetts. I think virtually every town in Vermont still does it. Many of them in New Hampshire do.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I didn't even know it was that many.
Oh, yeah. It's hundreds between those two states. Yeah. I don't know about Maine.
Yeah, there's a few left in Rhode Island. Anyway, we had a fight here about 6 years ago or so. Now, I'm calling concerning the hospital thing.
Right.
We have a partisan government, but I am a Democrat. And, you know, we had a hospital here at the time that was owned by a large conglomerate that was based in Tennessee. It was operating our hospital at a loss at the time. And long story short, there was another large conglomerate that wanted to come in, but it was based locally, and it was a local a Massachusetts hospital. But the money that came in from the conglomerate stopped it from coming in, which was really a big mistake, because even though we didn't lose our hospital, we could have had competition and we could have had more services, and which probably would have created a better health situation for the people in Metro West of Boston, which has about 1 million people in it. Mm-hmm. Now, I grew up in Bergen County, New Jersey, and there are three hospitals within 20 minutes of each other, Holy Name Hospital, Englewood Hospital, and Hackensack Medical Center. And it's an equal amount of people, about 1 million people live in Bergen County. And they used, the big conglomerate used, well, there's not enough people to support two hospitals. And, of course, I came from a place that had many more hospitals, many more services for the same amount of people in the region.
Was it a more affluent area? Was that the deal?
No, North Bergen, Bergen County, I mean, is affluent, but so is Metro West of Boston is somewhat affluent.
Right.
We have some of the most affluent places actually on the planet, in Sudbury, Massachusetts, and Weston and Wellesley.
Sure.
Very, very wealthy. If you give me 1 second, I do want to mention or comment on one thing. And I do feel horrible for the elected official, for the mayor. But just like the last caller, and I'm a pretty level guy, I am a somewhat at a loss of thought process. His party does hold national and local policy that created a lot of this mess.
Yep.
And for him not to divorce himself of that, really, I don't get that. That I don't get. If he's willing to walk,
you know, Lloyd, the Democratic Party up until 1965 or 64, arguably, was the party of segregation. It was the party of racism. It changed from within. And if the Republican Party is going to change from within, which is something that I think you and I, a goal we both share, it's going to change within because of people like Mayor O'Neill. We need people like him inside the party. We need him to be successful in that party, because this is a guy who's woken up. And that's why go to saveourhospital.org and help him out.
I'll say one more thing and then I'll go.
Sure.
Then there are people, all the Republicans listening, that feel like that mayor. You've been and start from the bottom up, because it's the only way to really change your party.
Yeah, I'm with you. Lloyd, thank you for the call, for a very thoughtful call. Appreciate it. Kevin in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I think that, you're right on a lot of things. I think you have some libertarian viewpoints that are really sort of indicative of the new thought of a lot of Republicans and younger Republicans. I'm registered as a Republican. I have to say, though, the guy who you talked to earlier, he was wrong. The U.S. is a corporation, and it's a failing corporation. And government is responsible for all the oppression in the world. And
if the U.S. is a corporation, with whom did we file our articles of incorporation?
Oh, I don't know, Tom, but,
it's because there is nobody. The United States is not a corporation. It's a sovereign nation. It issues its own currency. It establishes its own court system. It's a sovereign nation. It's not a corporation.
The U.S. was filed as a corporation back in the 1970s. I mean, it's on record.
Now you are going down that weird conspiracy theory road, Kevin. And let me warn you away from it. Those people are nuts.
Well, Tom, my point is that I'm a nurse. I've worked in medicine. I'm married to a doctor. All right, our government has failed us everywhere, and you can ask anybody. I was in the service. Anybody who's been through the VA system can tell you, government dealing with medicine and medical care is not a good thing. It never works well.
Well, that's not what I hear from people who use the VA system. In fact, Bernie, about 3 weeks ago, came on and said, I want to hear from veterans about your experience with the VA. We had one guy who called and complained, and everybody else was like, this is exactly what I need. It's wonderful.
Tom, there's nice ones, but most of them are hellholes.
You can say so, Kevin, but that's not what I'm hearing from listeners literally all over the country. You know, I get your Republican or Libertarian leanings and that you are unwilling to acknowledge the government can do anything well, but I'm guessing you probably had a public school education. I'm guessing that you drive on our public roads. I'm guessing that you support the fire department coming to your house if it burns down. You know, I don't get what part of government you think should be abolished.
Well, I think it doesn't have to be abolished, Tom. I think it has to be reclaimed by the people.
How? And that's, give me one example.
Well, either by revolution or by...
No, wait a minute. When the Koch brothers say that, we know what they're talking about. They're saying that they want their fossil fuel plants, their refineries to be able to emit more waste into the air, and they want Georgia-Pacific, they want their paper factories to be able to put more waste in the water. We understand when the Koch brothers say less government regulation, or lower taxes, we all know what they're saying. But when they get guys like you to say it, I don't think you know what you're talking about, Kevin. Can you please name for me one part of government or government regulation that you consider to be oppressive or tyrannical that we should do away with or that is so bad that it should be handed over to a private for-profit corporation?
Okay, Tom, I'll name one. Look, I'll name a bunch of them if you want. But the first one is the EPA, the U.S. military.
Okay, let's start with the EPA. So you think that if you've got... If you've got a plant owned by the Koch brothers upwind of you, and they are pumping out stuff out of their smokestack, out of their out of their factory or out of their refinery, you don't think that we the people should be able to regulate that? You think that the Koch brothers should be able to regulate themselves? Is that right?
No, Tom. I'm not a corporatist. I'm an anti-corporatist. Populist.
Okay, then who's gonna regulate the amount of destruction that they do into the commons or charge them for the cost of your cancers and your asthma from being downwind? Who's going to do that if not government?
Well, look at the EPA right now. They're ignoring Fukushima. The state of California is trying to...
Fukushima is not part of the United States.
No, but the radiation coming to California is, all right? The EPA has... Every state has their own environmental protection agency by a different name. My mom was the head of the Louisiana State Department of Environmental Qualities. She worked there for many years, and, you know, they did a better job than the EPA ever did. And why would we need all these extra people taking tax money, having huge retirement policies? People think
because there are predators out there, Kevin, and these federal employees that you are decrying are merely middle class workers. If you're upset that federal employees have a pension, have a retirement program, I think, again, you're being very, very myopic. Why shouldn't you be upset that the average working person in America doesn't have a retirement program? The people at McDonald's and Walmart don't have retirement programs.
Tom, I am. I'm just saying that people complain about other jobs in the corporate sector, but the private sector, but the government is responsible for the corporate sector. Our federal government gives all these one percenters their income. These big corporations, they make all their money from government, Tom. And the corporatists are in D.C.
No,
right
that's
now,
not true. Okay, so then you're arguing, you know, Microsoft makes their money because of the copyright laws and the trademark laws. So you're arguing against copyright and trademark laws? That's the part of government you do away with?
I'm arguing against fascism, Tom. That's it. That's it.
Yeah, all right. Kevin, thanks a lot for the call. We will live to fight again. My friend, I didn't hear what he said at the very end. Fighting against fascism. Okay, well, that's something I think we can all agree on, unless he's asserting that I'm one.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yeah, this is the thing. We have to distinguish between when billionaires say we want less government and when the average person who is benefiting from government says, welcome back, Corky. In Hilton, New York, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Corky, what's on your mind today?
Hello, Tom. That was a perfect segue to my call.
Okay.
You were saying about the conservatives believe a certain way and the liberal progressives believe a certain way. Right. The conservatives are told what to believe because when you have it on TV 24 hours a day, or you get in the car, and the radio stations on talk radio, they're telling you what to believe. They're mostly conservative radio stations.
Sure.
Now, when you get into the car of your youth driver in the house, they have it on music. They're not listening to it.
Right.
But the other entities in your house, the older ones that are interested in their life and their hospital closing and everything else, they will have it on talk radio. And the conservatives tell you what to believe. That guy could have been on Fox reading from a paper.
Yeah. Well, I'm guessing he watches a lot of Fox because those were basic, you know, corporatist talking points.
What drives me nuts is nobody remembers 30 years ago. They remember last week. You were talking about that scratch.
Well, he's probably not old enough to remember 30 years ago, and that's the problem. You've got a lot of people. You know, you and I, Corky, are old enough to remember before Reagan, to remember when every shopping mall in America had, you know, maybe one or two big chain stores as the anchors. You know, there was a Sears at one end and a Macy's at the other. But then all the stores in between were locally owned. The locally owned jewelry store, the locally owned electronics shop, the locally owned bead shop, the locally owned pottery shop, the locally owned clothing store. You know, they were all locally owned. They were all family businesses. Sometimes they've been in families for generations. The same thing with the downtowns in America. Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act, and these giant corporations started playing Monopoly, and now they've won. They've run the board.
Amen.
Well, you've got to be at least 45, 50 years old, I think, to remember that.
Do you remember back when 30% was the rule of thumb? Everything was 30%. Whatever it cost you to make an item, you would tack on a 30% profit and put it on the store shelf?
No, I think in retail, typically, it's what's called Keystone. It's 100%. You double the price from wholesale to retail.
Close that. Well, that was what the CEOs were making over and above the people who worked on the factory floor.
Right, they were making 30 times. It wasn't 30%. It was 3,000%. It was 30 times.
Okay, 30. Well, now look at it. 30 times is not enough.
You're right.
I mean, that's where they
now they're making 400 or 500 times.
Industry.
Yeah, which is 40 or 50,000%.
They can't make 3,000%.
Yeah. Well, now it's 40 or 50,000%.
When your economy goes.
And then you get people like the last guy who called me, who feel, you know, he knows he's being screwed. I mean, American household wealth has dropped. Here it is, economic inequality. The inflation-adjusted net worth for the typical household was $87,000 in 2003. 10 years later, it's only $56,000, a 36% decline in 10 years. People are getting poorer. And it's because of Reaganomics. This has been going on for 30 years. He knows he's been screwed. He doesn't know why. He thinks government must have done it to him. It wasn't government that did it to him. It was the banksters and the big corporations. Corky, to the extent the government might have empowered them, they did it. But that's not a good representative government. That's a government who is captive of those interests. Corky, thanks for the call. Which is why we need to amend the Constitution and say money's not speech and corporations aren't people. Up next, Victoria Jones. Stick around. Ten minutes before the hour here on the Truth People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, and Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com and Free-Don.org. Victoria, looks like you are in the White House.
I am indeed in the White House today. Yes.
How cool is that? So, what's going on there, and what have you learned? What's happening in the world today?
What's happening in the world today? Well, oh, excuse me. I nearly fell off my chair then. Don't want that, do we? Well, a lot of things and nothing terribly good. There are various things going on in Washington, D.C., because this is the last sort of week before congressmen and women and senators dash out of town for their five-week August recess.
Five-week vacation, and they will not...
Work period.
Okay. They will not, and these are the same people who will not vote for a woman who just gave birth to have 2 weeks of paid maternity leave.
That's correct.
Yeah. Bizarre. Okay.
That's correct. So they're going to dash off, but they've got a lot of things to do. One of the things is a Veterans Affairs bill. They've got to reconcile the Veterans Affairs bills. And this afternoon, Senator Bernie Sanders, the chair of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, Representative Jeff Miller, the chair of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, one is an independent, Sanders is independent, Miller's a Republican, are rolling out a tentative deal that they reached over the weekend on a Veterans Affairs bill. Now, they'd like to get this done, dusted, and signed by Thursday, because everybody knows it is a huge embarrassment if they can't even help the nation's veterans before they go home and face the constituents.
Now, is there any chance that in the it's 3 days this week, right? Aren't they in session Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in the 3 days of the congressional session that's going to officially start tomorrow and end on Thursday, is there any chance that John Boehner will bring to the floor for a vote the extension of long-term unemployment benefits? Even though they will have expired by now, it would mean that several million people would get a check for probably somewhere in the neighborhood of between $7,000 and $15,000. Be a huge stimulus to the economy. It would help people save their homes. Any chance John Boehner is going to do that?
Tom, if you look out your window and you see the lack of pigs flying.
Yeah, yeah.
That's because it's when pigs fly is when that's going to happen.
Okay. All right.
Yeah,
so
it's
yeah.
not on the agenda. It's not going to happen.
Yeah. All right. Well, I wish somebody was putting it on the agenda. I'm surprised that there's not like a National Association of Unemployed People who's out there lobbying really aggressively to get long-term unemployment benefits back. Anyway.
I mean, it would be a very interesting idea, and they're just not organized.
I mean, this has passed the Senate, and it would pass the House if John Boehner would just step out of the way and put it on the floor and let the Democrats and Republicans vote on it.
Well,
would pass.
The person who now has to bring it to the floor, of course, is House Majority Leader-elect Kevin McCarthy.
Oh, who is part of the caucus room conspiracy and said, we are going to oppose the president on every bill, even the things we support.
So I don't think it's going to come to the floor immediately.
Right. Yeah. Good point. Okay.
So
back to you.
The VA bill is going to provide the VA with at least $15 billion, much of it in emergency funding, and will give the VA secretary more control over the firing or demotion of senior executives in the department. Has a handful of other provisions to improve accountability and help veterans and active duty troops. There will be about $5 billion to hire more doctors, nurses, and help with improving VA's physical infrastructure, and $10 billion to help veterans access care from non-VA providers if they're unable to readily schedule appointments or don't live near VA facilities.
Great. Well, let's hope that they can get this thing out of committee and get it to the floor of both bodies for a vote.
Definitely.
What else is up?
Meanwhile, in Gaza today, explosions rocked a major hospital and a neighborhood of Gaza City, a playground, in fact, leaving at least 10 people dead, witnesses reported, as hopes faded for a break in the three-week-old conflict on the Muslim holiday of Eid. Among the dead were at least 7 children and 3 or 4 adults, and 70 people were also injured. Hamas officials blamed Israeli airstrikes. The Israelis blamed Hamas failed rocket launches, and so everybody's blaming everybody else for this. Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, is pleading for people to stop, for an immediate ceasefire. The U.S. is calling for an immediate ceasefire. And, of course, just after midnight, the U.N. Security Council, in emergency session, called for an immediate ceasefire as well.
Apropos of this topic, is David Gregory going to lose his job over that stunt he pulled on Sunday where he showed footage saying this is Hamas rockets coming out of a hospital? And UN footage, and then the UN comes out and says, no, it's not.
Well, there's talk that he may be losing his job anyway.
Uh-huh. Okay. So this is just, all right.
Yeah.
Moving along.
There's talk of that.
Yeah.
The UN's human rights chief is saying that the downing of the Malaysia Airlines jet in Ukraine may be a war crime. And, of course, pro-Russian Ukrainian rebels and the Ukrainian authorities have accused each other of shooting down flight MH17.
Right. And there is still no solid evidence as to any of the three parties involved, the Ukrainian government, the rebels, or the Russians. Everybody is saying, look at here, look at there. But or have I missed something? Is there some solid evidence of actually
Well, the U.S. claims that it has evidence that that Russia provide an SA-11 rocket launcher that it says was in the region, and that that it believes that Russian separatists fired the missile.
Right. Have they presented that evidence?
They have not presented concrete evidence. They've presented what they believe is close evidence.
Yeah. So, okay.
A Ukrainian official said today that MH17's data recorders show a massive explosive decompression caused by a rocket brought down the plane. Meanwhile, heavy fighting has again prevented international police from reaching the crash site. And finally, Representative Matt Salmon, Republican of Arizona, has introduced legislation that would prohibit federal funding for the National Endowment of the Humanities.
Oh, the humanity of it.
Yes, he thinks it doesn't deserve federal funding for frivolous projects.
Right. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goats for the old goat.com, free-don.org. Victoria, thank you.
Thank you.
Happy Monday. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. It being summer, anything goes summer here. I want to take the first little bit of this hour to take an opportunity to share something with you that I think is of value and I think is interesting. Last week, on Thursday and Friday, the week before last, we were going through Walking Your Blues Away and bilaterality and PTSD and all these kind of things. I would like to share with you another way to deal with unpleasant memories or things that are short of PTSD. That's really for the bilateral therapies, but are still, they're there. It's nagging. It's, feeling bad about it, that kind of thing. In an area called submodalities. Let me explain. This is a subset of neurolinguistic programming. And I'm taking this out of my book, Cracking the Code, which actually was written as a book about neurolinguistic programming, about NLP. And we put it in the context of politics, but it's actually a very good NLP book. And the modalities that we talked about last week, when we were going through Cracking the Code, the modalities, the principal modalities are sight, sound, and touch. And then also as primary modalities, but not, most people don't have them as their primary modalities, are smell, taste, and balance. These are the sensory systems that we have immediate and segregatable access to. You can just pay attention to what you're seeing. You can just pay attention to what you're hearing. You can just pay attention to what you're feeling or what you're tasting or what you're smelling or your balance relative to the room around you. So these are the primary modalities. And as I mentioned last week, typically most people have one that is their front and center modality. I've only ever known, actually in my life, I've known two people who have as their primary modality taste. They can remember, these people, both of them, can tell me when we got together by what we ate at the time. Oh, yeah, I remember back 2 years ago we got together and we had, and they will list everything that was on the menu that they ate. I have no recollection of it. But because and they're both people who have struggled all their lives with weight, which I find fascinating. And I'm not sure which is chicken and which is egg here. But principally, about 70% of Americans have visual as their primary modality, auditory as their secondary, and kinesthetic as their tertiary. Some people have auditory as their primary one. I do, for example. I think it's why I do radio well, is I catch auditory nuance. I'm not so concerned with how I look and how things around me look. And so my office, my desk tends to be a mess. I only reluctantly wear makeup on television. I don't wear it for the radio show. You can typically tell when somebody is primarily visual because every hair is in place. They're very, very conscious of how they look. And this is not a put down. I mean, this is, you know, visual people look at people who aren't visual and go, wow, look at that slob. And whereas people who are not visual look at visual people and go, look at how fastidious that person is. Why would they put all that effort into making sure that every, you know, but in any case. So then you've got people who have feelings as their primary way of experiencing the world, and they have a challenge learning. So what about the subsets of these modalities, and how does this influence how we remember things? And I'm going to give you an exercise for this, by the way. The subsets of visual modalities, the principal ones are, in other words, if I were to say to you, remember something that has recently happened to you that is either it's easiest to work with relatively unpleasant memories, you know, a waiter who treated you poorly or somebody who insulted you or, you know, a bad experience with a boss or a colleague, something that's not life-ending, it's not game-changing, it's just, you know, it's an irritation that you're still carrying around. And you still think about it. It still bothers you. Okay. When you look at that memory, and I use this visual language very advisedly, even knowing that some people who are principally auditory or kinesthetic, they can still access, usually, pictures. Some people are so kinesthetic they can't access a picture, and in which case I would say to them, when you bring up that the feeling of that experience, you may see a picture associated with it. And then they access the picture through their feelings. But in any case, you bring up that picture. Is it a still picture or a movie? Your memory of that event. Is it in color or black and white? These are the subsets of the visual modality. So we call them submodalities in neurolinguistic programming and NLP. How big is it? Where is it located in space? Usually when memories are really hot, they really affect us a lot, you ask somebody, where is it? Oh, it's right here, 2 feet in front of my face. Or 4 feet away. How big is it? Oh, it's, 4 feet square. You ask them about something that's irrelevant or something that they remember from a couple of weeks ago that they've processed, and they'll say, oh, yeah, it's about 15 feet off in the distance, and it's a black and white still picture. But color movies, and then you ask about the sound submodalities. Is there sound to it? Do you hear the voices? And if so, does the sound sound screechy or rumbly? I mean, has it been twisted in some way by your brain, so your memory, so that it seems more ominous or less? Or is it just a good, clean recording? So these are the sound submodalities. And then the feeling submodalities. Do you see yourself in the picture? If so, how are you feeling about that picture? Do you have a sensation somewhere in your body that is associated with this? I remember seeing Richard Bandler do this on stage in London back 15 or more years ago. And he had a guy come up on stage who had some horrible memory that was really troubling him. And this is one of the cool things about NLP is you don't have to reveal your secrets. We never learned what this guy's memory was. We just know that it was bad enough that it almost brought him to tears when he accessed it. And he was insisting that he could not bring up a picture. So Bandler said, okay, cool, come on up on stage. And he says, okay, bring that feeling up. Where is it? And the guy says, right here in my stomach and chest, my solar plexus. And Bandler says, is it spinning right or left? And the guy said, clockwise or counterclockwise? And the guy said, it's spinning. If you're looking from the front, it's spinning clockwise. And Bandler said, then take a giant metaphysical or mental crank handle, put it into it, and reverse the spin. Crank it in the other direction. And within less than 20 seconds, this guy was laughing about this memory that had been so horrible for him. That's shifting a kinesthetic submodality. So how do we, and the goal is always to produce this outcome, to take something out of a part of the brain that stores memories of I was hurt, I was a victim, I was in pain, to take it out of those places and have it relocate itself. And this happens automatically. The brain does this automatically. Have it relocate itself into a part of the brain that is where we store things. Oh, yeah, that happened to me and I learned from it. That was not all that pleasant, but, what I got out of it was, some benefit. In other words, there's, smarter, older and wiser kind of thing, And so move things out of the, oh, my God, this hurts, into the, boy, I'm glad that's over. And, gee, here's what I learned from it. And so we're going to go through, after the break, in 5 minutes, 4 minutes, we're going to go through exactly how you do that with a visual or auditory submodality. I already told you how to do it with a kinesthetic submodality. And I'll give you the specific example of how to do it, and you can try it yourself, try it with others. This is just fun stuff. It doesn't require a degree. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And let me be very clear. This is not medical advice or psychology advice. This is discovering how our brains work. It's fascinating. And welcome back. We're going to get to that NLP stuff in just a few minutes when our commercial radio stations rejoin us. But for right now, Thomas in Garden Grove, California, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Thomas, what's on your mind?
Hello.
Hey, Thomas, you're on the air.
All right. Yeah, I was calling you about the IQ of Democrats and Republicans. And then a friend of mine who looks up all the information on things like that says there's about a 10-point difference between Republicans and Democrats, the Democrats being higher in IQ. So it's kind of interesting. And then you look down in Louisiana and compare it with IQs of people in Massachusetts, and it's all over the nation. It's the IQs are a lot of difference.
Yeah, and one of the things we know about IQ is that it is highly variable as a consequence of upbringing. When children are exposed to thousands of words, a wide vocabulary in their first 2-3 years of life, their IQ is much higher than a child who's only exposed to hundreds of words during their first 2 or 3 years of life. And so having parents who are more well-educated, this is not a matter of genetics. This is a matter of nurture, not nature. And children of poverty, children of deprivation, children of insularity, small communities where nobody ever leaves town and nobody's ever gone anywhere else in the world, much less the county or the state or the country. The consequence of that is actually a lower measurable IQ. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily dumber when it comes to certain types of intelligence. They may be very, very smart when it comes to cunning or when it comes to empathy or when it comes to even the non-intellectual intelligences, so physicality, the ability to be an athlete, that sort of thing. But it does mean that if they take an IQ test, which requires vocabulary skills, math skills, things like that, they're going to score lower. And, yeah, you're right. This is the case, and the Republicans have been making hay with this since the 60s. This was the basis in part of the Southern Strategy. People with low IQs, the low IQ tends to associate with that insularity and that poverty. They also tend to be people who are very racist, for lack of a better word. So,
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I want to know.
Okay. Good point, Thomas. Thank you very much for the call. And this, I mean, this actually, when you look at what Lyndon Johnson did in the 60s with his war on poverty, his Great Society, and one of the things he did was he started, I believe he started the Head Start program. It might have preceded him, but he certainly, if he didn't start it, he certainly amplified it. And it was, let's reach kids before they reach kindergarten. And let's expand their vocabulary. Let's expand their social skills. Let's enhance their ability to play with others and to interact with others. These things will produce better citizens over time. It makes them more well-equipped to deal with school over time. So pretty straightforward stuff. And as these states dial back these programs, as Republicans say, we don't need no stinking Head Start. It's another damn government program. We're going to cut it. We're going to cut funding for it, as they've done repeatedly now over the last 15 years. What do you see? Kids in poor areas are just not doing as well. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here. We'll be 20 minutes past the hour. And I'm just going to share this very, very simple technique with you. You can follow along with us, although if you're driving, I would suggest you not do that because it can be a distraction from your driving. It's very simple. Once you understand it, you don't have to know the exact language that I'm using. You don't have to remember the exact order of things because it's basically the principle of the thing. Just like with bilaterality, we talked about that. We started out with some very specific things that were done. You know, James Braid moving the watch back and forth with the eyes. But, you know, it turns out you can do it just standing in place, moving, you know, left toes, right toes, left toes, right, and nobody even knows it, right? So how do we do submodality shifts? Well, first of all, why are they important? When the brain stores, when our mind stores information, our mind sorts and stores information based on emotional content. And that emotional content has a set of submodalities associated with it. So things that are, you know, bad memories tend to have a particular visual quality to them and a particular auditory quality and a particular feeling associated with them. And they are located, and if you ask the person, where is this located, they can point to it. They can say, there it is, right there. There it is over there. Or it's right in here, or it's right over here. So what we do with submodality shifts is, I mean, the brain is constantly, it's a self-healing mechanism. And it's constantly looking for opportunities to make things better. And so what we're doing by interfering, basically, or interrupting the pattern of where a memory is stored, and by changing the submodalities associated with that storage, what we are doing is giving the brain an opportunity to change the submodalities, and what that does is it automatically relocates into a different part of the brain the memory. Now, when you relocate the memory into a different part of the brain, the meaning of the memory changes. And you will experience this if you do this exercise, and you can walk other people through it, and you'll notice that they will experience it too. It's really simple stuff. Kids can do it. Adults can do it. This is not psychology. This is brain science. It's fascinating stuff. So, for example, I did this on the air with a woman back in 2006 when I was writing Cracking the Code. And because we were writing the book on the air, I was inviting people to call in and say, you know, let me do this with you. And this woman named Barbara called. This was December 15th, 2006. And her name was Barbara. She was calling from Los Angeles. Tom, hi, Barbara. Thanks for calling in. What I'd like you to do is remember something in the recent past, the last week or so, it was a moderately unpleasant experience. The example that I'd like to give is like somebody flipping you off in traffic or a surly waiter. Barbara, yeah, I got one. Tom, you got one. Okay, great. This is from page 61 of my book, Cracking the Code. Tom, you got one. Okay, great. Now, I want you to describe to me the submodalities associated with it. In other words, when you remember that experience and you see the picture of that, do you see the picture in color or black and white? Barbara says, color. I said, okay, describe in space where it is. Is it in front of you, behind you? Where is it, like 5 feet in front of you, 20 feet in front of you, 6 feet off to your left? Barbara says, in front of me. Tom, it's in front of you. How far away? Barbara, I would say 10 to 5 feet. Tom, 5 feet. Okay, is there sound associated with it? Barbara, yes, there's sound. Okay, is it a movie or a still picture? It's a movie, she says. Okay, great. So what I'd like you to do, Barbara, and by the way, I can tell you, I remember this. Her voice was very, very sober, very somber. This was a memory she did not like. What I'd like you to do is push that picture about twice as far away from you. Push it like 10, 15, 20 feet away from you, first of all. She says, okay, I've done it. Now, the reason you have somebody do that is to just get some space. We have this cliche in our culture, I need some space from that. Right? Well, you can literally push it away, and that's the first submodality shift. You've changed it spatially. She says, okay, I've done it. And I said, okay, now try and turn it black and white. She says, okay, that's hard. That's hard to turn it into black and white. And I said, okay, interesting. Well, we can leave it color if you want. Maybe your brain doesn't want it black and white yet. Barbara, no, my brain does not want it black and white. Okay, that's cool, I said. Leave it as color. I want you to scroll all the way to the end of the movie and freeze frame it. She says, okay, I've freeze framed it. And I say, and now in just a second, I'm going to make a whoosh sound, and I'm going to ask you to play it backward. And you know how when you play an old movie backward, everybody moves like in the old Charlie Chaplin movies, and everybody talks, Chaplin movies, and everybody talks backwards like Donald Duck? I want you right now to play it backward all the way back to the beginning with everything going backward, whoosh, just like that. And she says, yep, yep, I did. I said, okay, all the way back to the beginning. Now freeze frame it at the beginning. Do you see yourself in the picture, or do you see it as if you were there? She said, I see myself in the picture. Now this is called dissociated. This is a dissociated picture. An associated picture is where you see everything. You don't see yourself. You're seeing it as if you're there looking through your eyes. A dissociated picture is where you're standing outside and you're seeing yourself in it. Okay. I said, okay, great. What I'd like you to do is I'd like you to paint rainbows across that picture now and put donkey ears on everybody in the picture except yourself. She says, okay. I said, okay, now how do you feel about the experience right now? And she starts laughing. And she said, what I did is I went back to the beginning and I said, okay, this didn't happen that way. And so I said, aha, you're laughing now. A few minutes ago, you weren't laughing about this experience. Barbara says, no, I wasn't. And so I said, okay, number one, you're laughing now. And number two, what you just told me is that the story about the experience has changed. Has it? The story that you tell yourself about what happened there? She said, yeah. And I said, typically what happens is stories change from, oh, gee, I was a victim, to, oh, that happened, but I learned from it. Was that the kind of transition? She said, no, the transition was, okay, that happened. Let's just accept it and deal with it. That's it. Instead of being so anxious about it. And so I said, okay, so have you transformed a memory by simply shifting the filing system that your brain uses for it? And she said, oh, yes, absolutely. Thank you, Tom. And I said, you're welcome. Thanks, Barbara. Oh, that's how you do it. It's very simple. It's very straightforward. It's in my book, Cracking the Code, but it's in a lot of good books on NLP. There's no shortage of them out there.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Now that we're done with our NLP 101 course for the day, we'll go back to Anything Goes Friday. I'll pick up your calls after this. Speaking the truth, the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know all about. Tom Hartman here with you. And John in San Diego, California. Hey, John, you're on the air. What's up? John? No, John. Okay, let's try Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Hey, Ed, can you hear me? Uh-oh. Have we had a system failure here? Let's try Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Paul, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Tom.
Okay, great. So what's up, Paul?
Hey, I'm curious from last week. Can you hypnotize yourself? Hypnotize yourself?
Yes, you can. And in fact, I shared with you the Betty Erickson, she called it the Betty technique, for putting yourself to sleep. It is a form of self-hypnosis. And what you do is simply cycle through three times. You cycle through the five principal modalities. Notice what you see, notice what you hear, notice what you feel, notice what you taste, notice what you smell, and then start again. And you do that three times, spending maybe 5 or 10 seconds with each one as you're trying to fall asleep, and you will fall asleep because you will put yourself into a trance.
So do you move your eyes from side to side?
No, you don't have to do anything. Just notice. It's just notice, you know, what you're seeing. If your eyes are closed, you may be seeing a kaleidoscope of color. You may just be seeing blackness.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, you know. But just, you know, notice each one of those senses in turn and focus on it for a moment, long enough to really be very present with it, and then move on to the next one. And you do that by the time you've done that three times. By the time most people have done that three times, they're asleep.
Well, I know walking your blues the way it works. I mean, I have to go. I go for a walk, about 6-7 miles every morning. I have to. If I don't go, I have a terrible day.
Yeah. Well, Thomas Jefferson did that his entire life, and he wrote a long letter in his personal letters to his nephew, to either his brother or sister's son, who he had sort of adopted as his surrogate son, and he was constantly writing him letters of advice. And he talked about how when he woke up in the morning, even before breakfast, he had to walk for a mile, and he carried a gun with him, not so much as he ever thought he'd need the gun, but that it was, you know, just something to have, you know, as part of the walk. I think it was part of his whatever, I don't know. But, you know, he was just totally committed to that. Another story that I think is in Walking Your Blues Away was Charles Dickens. Charles Dickens could not write unless he had first walked for at least an hour. And regardless of the time of day, if he sat down to write and he just couldn't make things flow. And so he would go out, he'd walk for about an hour around downtown London, and then he'd come back home and it would all be right there in front of him.
Yeah, it's a great thing. I have to go for my, you know, I do a little walk and jog every morning.
Yep.
And just, I mean, I can't get my day going if I don't. I just feel like if something's on. But, you know, you're talking about memory. I'm having fun with this, Tom. So I'm writing a, I guess it's, a, I don't know, it's my book, the start of my book.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about how we first discovered that I was going blind. And this is when I was 4 years old.
Uh-huh.
And this all takes place, the first part of it. First chapter of it, I suppose, is when we were on a vacation up and, you know, going up north in Michigan. And so I was trying to, you know, I have these fragments of memory, but I think they're pretty real, but I was trying to check how accurate they are. And I thought, I really wonder, and I've asked people in the family, what do you remember about that trip? You know, the trip to Long Lake in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, okay, so I'm pretty well on. Nobody's remembered anything really different, but I was looking for a piece of evidence, and I was talking to this friend of mine about how during that trip we used to sing. There was a cornflakes commercial on television, and we used to sing it in the car because it was really funny. And I was singing it to a friend of mine, and I was singing it. And I could only remember some of the words. And I said, and I was singing it to her, and I said, man, I wonder if this is like YouTube or something. And sure enough, it was. This was a commercial from 1963.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen it in over 50 years. So I put it on, and I was singing it in the same key.
Wow.
As the after 50 years.
That's
I was
pretty impressive,
because
usually memories shift slightly. You know, that's great.
So I knew that was a piece of archaeological evidence that I thought, yeah, these memories that I have are, they have not been conflated over the years.
Right, they're pretty spot on. That's great.
Yeah. So, but... Well, let me finish up with the idea of that government it should be run like a business, or the government is a corporation. It makes me wonder if people who say that, and usually are proclaimed to be experts on business, that they don't understand what government is or what a corporation is. And really, I mean, when you think about it, a corporation is supposed to turn a profit, you know, and in so doing, they have to identify a market. A particular niche market. Government has to serve everyone. And if government is turning a profit, by the way, what's the problem? You're being overtaxed.
Right.
And you're not getting what you're paying for.
Yeah, I think, for example, it's obscene that our government is making billions of dollars on the student loan program.
It is. And the other thing is,
if government is just breaking even, because we always hear about, oh, wow, American families have to live on a budget and so should government. Well, actually, that's not true. Most American families are hundreds of percents more in debt versus their GDP. Right. than the government is. I mean, if you make $100,000 a year, you would easily qualify for a $300,000 mortgage.
Right.
That right there puts you 300% of GDP, plus your car and your credit card. So, no, most families are living far more in debt than the United States government. But the idea that government is supposed to make, even if government's just breaking even, in other words, you're getting only what you pay for, that means the government's not investing in anything either. So by necessity, government almost has to run at a deficit.
Right.
Because otherwise it's not investing in any future. You're only getting what you're paying for. And that's it.
It's an excellent point.
I mean, otherwise you're not putting in money, you're not investing in anything, you're not putting any money aside for anything,
right.
And you're just going.
The other piece of this, Paul, that because our language here is fairly abstract, that a lot of people miss when we're talking about government, is that the return on investment from government programs should not be monetary; it should be social. So, in other words, it can be measured monetarily frequently. You build a billion-dollar highway system, and it facilitates, $500 billion worth of commerce. Or
right.
you educate, 16 million Americans with a GI Bill, and it costs you, $5 billion, and you get $15 billion during the course of their lifetimes in additional taxes back. And I'm just making these numbers up. I have no idea what they really are. But really what you're looking at is that highway system, not only did it facilitate all that commerce and thus, quote, show a profit, but in the course of facilitating that commerce, it improved the quality of life for everybody. In the course of educating these returning GIs, you get more engineers and scientists and inventors and social scientists and teachers and therapists and physicians. And society is richer for it. And so whenever we're looking at government programs, and this is where, when Victoria said that some Republican is proposing a piece of legislation to cut funding to the National Institute of the Humanities or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
It's like these are appropriate functions of government to improve the quality of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And as the second half of that sentence says in the Declaration, when government fails to provide for happiness, that it is the duty, it is the obligation of the people to change that form of government.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And also the Constitution says we should invest in arts and sciences.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. It's in Article 1, Section 8.
That's right.
Yeah.
So the goals of business and government are so different that, I mean, if you tried to, people say, well, if you ran business like the way we're running government, the business will go out of business. Well, try to run a business doing the functions that government must do. In other words, try to run a business by trying to serve everybody. That's no business model.
Right.
You can't run a business by trying to serve everybody.
Right, whether they can pay or not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It everybody gets Social Security. Well, you can't. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yes, you're right. Excellent point. Paul, excuse me. I missed my sneeze button on that one. I'm sorry to inflict that on you.
I would have pushed it for you.
Pardon?
I would have pushed it for you if I could.
Okay. Yeah, it's right. My foot has to hit it, and somehow it got moved.
Oh, yeah, here it is. So,
there we go. So, anyhow, we have a half a minute left, Paul. Have you ever tried these submodality shifts I was describing?
No, but I need to do something, Tom, because, I suffer from a bit of an anxiety disorder because of, at this point in my life, my eyesight is on the real decline, and it's caused me a lot of consternation and anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so,
in other words, you're imagining really bad futures and letting them impinge on your present.
Well, that and just what I look through every day, what my eyes see every day is that it's, most people say, my glasses give me a headache, and I'm like, you look through my eyes, you'll have a headache.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm thinking about something that could deal with this anxiety,
Yeah. I'm reluctant to to do anything that might sound like I'm playing a shrink on the radio here, Paul. But what I will say in general is that most anxiety disorders, even justified ones, have a component of imagining a terrible future and experiencing that imagination in the present. You might want to think about that. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And then on the other hand, sometimes anxiety isn't a disorder at all. It's an entirely appropriate response to something. But if it's something that's inevitable, you want to try and diminish that response as much as possible. And welcome back. Okay, that would be Morris in Long Beach, California, watching on KPFK. Or listening on KPFK out of L.A. Hey, Morris, what's on your mind today?
Professor, foreign countries invest in our government quite a bit. Is there a foreign country that would be willing to invest in moving our Congress to the left by donating $50 million so that we can get a massive voters registration going on in this country and make us a little bit more peaceful as opposed to more warlike, a military kind of people?
You know, maybe you could convince the Scandinavian governments. Europe has been increasingly buying into Wolfowitz neocon neoliberalism, you know, which is kind of tragic. But the Scandinavian, Norway is the largest provider of foreign aid on a per capita basis in the world. Maybe they would be interested in seeing us become more of a democracy, but I doubt it. I don't think anybody's investing in our government, Morris. What they're investing in is our businesses, our infrastructure, our land, our buildings. They're buying the stuff that is part of part of America, so that they can make a profit on it. They're buying our factories, things like that.
Professor, you don't believe that foreign entities invest in our politics?
I do. There's particularly some of these transnational corporations. But, I mean, the second largest stockholder of Fox News, of News Corp, is a Saudi citizen, Saudi prince.
Bingo. I'm looking for a rebellious Saudi prince.
Yeah. Well, you're probably not going to find, the Saudis are rather right-wing authoritarian in their
Amen.
Worldview and perspective. That's why I'd look to Norway. But, and there's probably a few Norwegian billionaires, although their taxes are pretty high there. I doubt there's a lot of them. But it's an interesting idea.
I am going to look into that.
Okay, Morris, thanks a lot for the call. You put it out there in the ether. You never know what's going to happen. Bob in Sacramento, California, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just want to respond to that libertarian nurse who was trashing every bit of government. And in specifically the VA, I recently had 3 stents put in my heart by the VA, and I'm significantly better off for it.
And, I've heard that's the case.
Yeah, and I found out that I was eligible for the VA by calling the Obamacare Exchange in California, and they referred me to the VA. And within 9 weeks of applying for the VA, I was having stents put into my heart.
Wow. And you had no insurance before that?
I don't want to tell you the whole story, but it's a long and interesting. The people that I tell the story to like the story, but it's too long to tell on the air.
Yeah. But you had no insurance before this?
I had no insurance whatsoever.
And your heart was, at that point, basically a time bomb if it needed 3 stents.
It was very much a time bomb. I had been having heart-based incidents since 2005.
Wow.
And I'm your age.
Wow.
I'm 61.
Yeah. You're actually 2 years younger than me.
Yeah, But
you're Louise's age.
I get incensed with these libertarians that the only thing they're right about is the drug war and foreign wars.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're riding that as far and as long as they can. Bob, thanks a lot for the call. I'm glad to hear that you're feeling better. And thanks for listening. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Sanchez in Long Beach, California. Hey, Sanchez, what's up?
Hey,
Hey, Dr. Hartman, I wanted to bring up this morning, I wanted to point out just how biased our American media is concerning the Israel-Gaza conflict. Right. Now, you correctly pointed out, actually Ellen Radner correctly pointed out, this incident that happened with David Gregory and Meet the Press, where they broadcast false Israeli government propaganda via a video that proposed that the rockets were being fired from a UN school, but there was no way to identify it. So at the end of the program, David Gregory had to issue a retraction. This was now after an official from the UN was disputing this fact.
Right.
So there's no accountability for Israel for that, but the one small morsel of truth that was issued on Friday via the New York magazine's Daily Intelligencer, it's a segment that they do, the writer Katie Zavadsky, along with John Donison, the senior reporter for the BBC, both reported that chief inspector for the he's the foreign press spokesman for the Israeli police, his name is Mickey Rosenfeld, reportedly told the BBC journalist, John Donison, that the men responsible for murders of those three teenagers, this is the thing that set off the entire massacre that's now going on in Gaza. He said that the murders, these men were not acting on orders of the Hamas leadership. Now, this has been emphatically stated by Hamas. He said that they are part of a lone cell. And further, Inspector Rosenfeld told Donison that if the Hamas leadership had ordered the kidnapping, they'd have known about this in advance. Now, it's a well-known fact that Israel knows the whereabouts of practically everyone walking in the streets of Gaza. They have it's like a prison. These people have to register. They have to report their whereabouts. All of this stuff.
There's cameras all over.
How is it that something like this, reporting that possibly Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has jumped the gun and started this entire massacre of the people of Gaza over what could be either a mistake or a false accusation. So we have two incidents here. We have Israel, the Israeli government, providing videos that turn out to be false, and then we have Benjamin Netanyahu jumping the gun and starting this entire massacre just on the presupposition that Hamas might have killed those three teenagers. And there's one last thing I would like to point out. Under the 1949 Geneva Conventions, collective punishment is a war crime. And that's what you're seeing right now, because the IDF is bombing Palestinian citizens. So everybody in Palestine, everybody in Gaza, I should say, is suffering for the crime of three lone people. Now, that is a crime, yes. Those people, whoever it was that killed those three teens, that's a crime. But that is not a war crime.
Yeah.
So nobody in the American press is pointing that out.
Well, you just did, Sanchez. And I would add a little bit more nuance to that, principally by pointing out that this did not start with the killing of three Israeli teenagers. The killing of three Israeli teenagers, just like, you know, having a 2-foot-high pile of gunpowder on the floor that finally explodes because somebody drops a match on it, did not start when somebody lit the match. It started when people started piling up the gunpowder, if you understand my metaphor. This situation has been a long time in the making. It is the consequence of both Israeli policy toward Gaza and Hamas's absolute unwillingness to recognize the right of Israel to exist. And it's something that I think that was losing them a lot of support to the point that they were just about to go out of business. And now the way that Netanyahu is responding, or the way that Israel is responding to this, to these rockets and whatnot, A, the rockets themselves, and then the response is actually, it appears, strengthening the hand of Hamas, when, in fact, what would have been best both for the Gazans and for Israel is if Hamas was replaced by somebody like Mahmoud Abbas, who you know, with the Palestinian Authority, who actually is a high integrity partner for peace, somebody who's willing to say, yes, we recognize your right to exist. We're not going to relitigate 1948. Now let's move forward. And so, you know, I think your points are well made. Thank you for the call. Cody in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Cody, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was listening to what you were saying about NLP, and I was curious if you're familiar with the EMDR technique and if they're at all similar.
I am. I have.
It seems like from what you're saying that they're very similar, but are they used for different purposes or different people, or how do they how are they different, and when do you use one than the other?
EMDR, eye motion desensitization and reintegration, I think is what the acronym stands for. It was invented by Francine Shapiro back about three decades ago. It is something that 4 or 5 decades ago you can find videotapes of Steve Andreas and Richard Bandler teaching a very, very similar technique and putting it in the context of mesmerism and hypnosis. And, you know, it's eye motion from left to right while a person is remembering a traumatic experience, it put it in its most simple form. Francine did a brilliant job of taking this one specific thing, this one little slice of what I would call NLP. I'm not sure she would or not. And doing good science on it, tens of thousands of people, and mostly in collaboration with the VA, but she's run, she and other groups have run good scientific studies on tens of thousands of people using EMDR as a solution for PTSD and other trauma. It works the vast majority of the time. It's highly successful. And I tip my hat to Francine. That said, I can't teach EMDR. You've got to be licensed by Francine. You've got to pay a fee to her. And so I acknowledge it. I think it's wonderful stuff. But what I'm teaching is not, and talking about here, and what I write about is not EMDR. EMDR is a whole, from her point of view, it's a whole separate thing. To me, I think that there's a lot of overlap. Is that making sense, Cody?
Yeah, great. That's good info. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for the call. The fact of the matter is, if you're not, licensed by Francine, and you say what you're doing is EMDR, they come down on you with a large foot. Not a good idea to do it. For us, not for them. You got to protect. They have to protect their trademark, and I understand that. So, thanks so much for being with us today. And, beginning of a great new week. Remember, the best way to deal with your emotions about how things are going today is to get active. Tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy something. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.